Thank you, Rabbi Weissman. Again, my name is Binyamin Kamenetsky. It's a pleasure to be here today. Thank you all for coming and hearing about the wonderful work that the Beis Din does. My topic today is the BDAs, the Beis Din America's prenuptial agreement, which was first written in the mid-1990s. Rabbi Willie, who spoke earlier, was the main designer of that with help of others. The document has been changed over the years, and we're going to talk about that a little bit today. But what I'm very proud of is that the prenuptial agreement is by far the most effective tool that Beis Din has to combat the Aguna crisis, full stop. And that is something that we're very proud of, and that's something that, that Baruch Hashem, the community, has embraced. So what I'm here to do today is to just talk a little bit about the prenuptial agreement with an emphasis on the legal aspects of it. Unlike all the other speakers who are tremendous Talmidei Chachamim, I'm an Ama Aretz, but I do know something about the law. So I'm going to talk about more of the legal aspects of the prenuptial agreement. And if anyone has any halacha shailos about it, you can wait for the Q&A session. If anyone has any questions about the legal aspects, you could interrupt me or wait till the end. So before we talk about anything else, and apologize for some of the silly cartoons, but they keep me entertained, is what are we solving for? What's the problem? What's the issue that has caused for thousands of years the Aguna crisis? And the problem is this, or the thing we're solving for, is that under Jewish law, a husband has to be the one to initiate the get. That's number one. And number two, if a husband is coerced into granting a get, then the get or the divorce is invalid. Okay, so what we have to do to find an effective solution to the Aguna crisis, an effective halachic solution to the Aguna crisis, is to walk this tightrope between, the husband has to initiate the get, but can't be forced to give the get. So there's been a number of solutions proposed over the years. Rabbi Ries talked about the ksuba, and I think what we heard from Rabbi Ries, this is how we ended, is that the ksuba in and of itself is not the answer to the Aguna crisis. That having to pay the ksuba is not a reason, by and large, that a husband will be will give a get that otherwise he doesn't want to have to give. There was efforts. There were two New York get laws that were instituted. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. There was one in 1979 that was pushed by the Agudas Yisrael. That turned out to be ineffective or not totally effective for a number of reasons, among them that only the plaintiff in a divorce proceeding could trigger what the get law did. So if it turns out that the wife was the defendant, that really the 1979 New York get law didn't really help her in any way with respect to the get. Then there was the second get law in 1992, which was and remains quite controversial, in that a number of rabbanim felt that pushed the husband into the get meusa category, the compelled get, and that a get given under the 1992 get law, according to a number of poskim, had a cloud over it in that it had a issues of get ba'usa, which is a forced get, and therefore fell over the tightrope in that way. In fact, again, it's a minority opinion, but just to tell you how seriously this issue is, some minority rabbis took the view that because of the second get law, any get done in New York had a cloud over it, because maybe the husband was only giving the get out of fear of being caught into the web of the second New York get law. So the New York get law, both the 79 and 92 get law, again, wasn't the solution, I think, that we needed to the Aguna crisis. Number one, because of the controversy I just said with respect to the 1992 get law, and number two, because the New York get law, by definition, only applied in New York. So, So that brings us to the Beis Din of America prenuptial agreement. So what is the Beis Din of America prenuptial agreement? Look at page 21 of your handout booklet. We're not going to read everything. So what's the secret sauce? Bottom line, how does this work? So basically, two things. This is the secret sauce. Number one is the first provision where the husband and wife-to-be agrees to submit to the jurisdiction of the Beis Din to arbitrate a dispute regarding the end of their marriage. That's section one. And section two, and this is really the secret sauce, is that if you look, it's what we're looking at, section three of the prenup on page 21, which basically says, I'm just going to read the important parts. Furthermore, I hereby now may Achshav obligate myself to support my wife-to-be from the date that our domestic residence together shall cease for whatever reason at the rate of $150 per day in lieu of, so long as the two of us remain married according to Jewish law, even if she has another source of income or earnings. Basically, so what this says is, number one, you submit to jurisdiction of the Beis Din, and number two, that once the Beis Din determines that your marriage is over, the husband is required to give a get or pay the wife $150 per day until the get is given. And according to halakha, is this, because we're talking about a support obligation and not a fine, this doesn't fall into the get meusa category. And so that's number one. And number two, because this is an arbitration agreement, it's fully enforceable in a court of law, as we'll talk about in a moment. So again, what's the secret sauce of the BDA prenuptial agreement? It's the $150 support obligation that the husband is taking upon, husband-to-be is taking upon himself at the time or before marriage, that if the Beis Din determines the marriage is over, you either give a get or you pay $150 per day. So a number of years ago, I think it was 5 or 6 years ago, I was asked by the Beis Din of America to take a fine-tooth comb to the then-existing prenuptial agreement and do a top-to-bottom review and anticipate any legal challenges that could be mounted against the prenuptial agreement on the theory that, you know, this only way this thing works is if it could be fully enforceable in a court. So just before we get there, let me just go through like arbitration 101 so that everyone's on the same page in terms of how you enforce arbitration agreements. I know a lot of you are lawyers, so you could tune out now if you know this. The way it works is if you forget Beis Din, forget everything else, if Rabbi Reese and I have a dispute, either of us have a right to take the other one to court. No offense, Rabbi Reese. We don't have a dispute. However, if we sign a arbitration agreement, right? If I tried it before, you know, we go into business or what have you, if I have to try to take Rabbi Reese to court, I sue him in court, Rabbi Reese will take out the arbitration agreement and a court will enforce that and say, sorry, you waived your right to a court of law, you have to go arbitrate. So a court will enforce, court in all 50 states and all federal courts will enforce an arbitration agreement between the parties. If you agree to not go to court, they're more than happy to say, Gesinde Haag, go arbitrate. So we go to an arbitration based in what have you, any type of AAA arbitration. I win, I lose. So I win, the arbitrators say, Rabbi Reese owes me $1,000. I say to Rabbi Reese, pay me $1,000. Rabbi Reese says, no, I'm not paying you $1,000. What do? I can't go to the arbitrators because the arbitrators they don't have any power to come after Rabbi Reese's assets. I don't know how we got here, but I'm sorry. So what do? I then go take the arbitration award to court, and the court will confirm the arbitration award. What does that mean? Is that the court won't relitigate the case. They will do a very, very basic review, and the only grounds to frustrate an arbitration award are extraordinarily narrow. It has to be, if Rabbi Reese could show that it was based on fraud or against public policy, or something really out of the ordinary happens, he might have a shot of frustrating the world, but generally 99 out of 100 times, all that a court will do is rubber stamp the arbitration award. I could then take that court order, give it to the sheriff, and the sheriff could come and take $1,000 from Rabbi Reese. So that's arbitration 101. So my goal is to make sure, our goal when I was proposed by the Based in America was to make sure that if the prenuptial agreement was signed, and if the Based in determined that the marriage is over, and if the Based in therefore awarded the $150 per day, the wife can go to court, get that confirmed, and the court will order the husband to turn over the money, right? So that was my goal. So what kind of things keep me up at night or kept me up at night, and what kinds of things did we recommend to the, or did we think about when taking a close look at the prenuptial agreement and suggesting changes and redrafting it into the document that you see here. So I don't want to spend much time there, but in case anyone is worried, well, you know, we do live in a free country. We have a First Amendment. Maybe folks were saying perhaps a court wouldn't force someone to go to a religious arbitration. Fine, going to a secular arbitration, but I'm a husband, and I say, listen, I don't believe in this stuff anymore. You, court of law, can't force me to sit in front of a bunch of rabbis to adjudicate my financial rights. The answer is you're out of luck, because consistently, as you see one case here, courts do enforce arbitration agreements, even if it's to go arbitrate in front of a religious body like a Beis Din. In addition, awards of a Beis Din are regularly confirmed by a secular court. The secular court finds that, listen, for us to confirm a arbitration award, we don't have to get into issues of Shochan Aruch, of Yeridea, of Chomshei Mishpat, or anything else. All we have to do, it says that you know, Rabbi Reese owes Binyamin Kamenetsky $1,000. We just have to say, you owe him $1,000. There's nothing religious about that. So a court will confirm a arbitration award, a financial arbitration award. And in fact, as Rabbi Willig mentioned, our prenuptial agreement has been challenged in court, and it has been upheld in court as a valid agreement. So what kind of other challenges can someone try to mount against the prenuptial agreement, and what did we do to address that? Before I go on, the passcode for this section will be TURTLE. So if you're at home watching this or watching this in the future and ask for your passcode, the passcode is TURTLE. The first issue that we discussed, well, let me start here. A prenuptial agreement or a premarital agreement is a contract, right? It's a simple contract. So harken back to first year law school. Contracts have certain requirements. So certainly, at the very least, a prenuptial agreement has to accord with the dictates of what a valid contract or an enforceable contract is. However, many states, not all, but many states have, either by common law or by statute, requires more stringent requirements for premarital agreements. If you see here, and the question is then, well, is the Beis Din of America prenuptial agreement a premarital agreement under the law? So on one hand, like, you know, in the real world, you would say no, because a premarital agreement or a prenuptial agreement in the real world is about something completely different. It's about, okay, we get divorced, who gets what, right? This isn't really about that, or it's not primarily about that. This is about, you know, kind of obligating the husband to either give the get or money. However, if you look at the various definitions of a premarital agreement, it would seem that the Based in America prenuptial agreement would fit into that definition. So as a result, I think there are good arguments to make that the Based in America prenuptial agreement shouldn't be considered a premarital agreement. I think, you know, as a technical matter, if you read the cases and you read the statutes, I think you would agree with me based on what you see over there on the board, that because it is an agreement made in contemplation of marriage, that a court could find that it is a premarital agreement. So although, to be fair, there are There are certain cases that say that religious premarital agreements, like an Islamic mahr agreement, which is somewhat like a tsuba, is not considered a premarital agreement under the law. However, that's a controversial issue. In fact, courts in Ohio, New Jersey, and Florida have found that an Islamic mahr agreement is a premarital agreement. There's something now called the Uniform Premarital and Marital Agreements Act, and the note there suggests that the prenuptial agreement or the BDA prenuptial agreement and the MAR agreement would not be a premarital agreement. But as far as I know, that new act has only been passed in North Dakota and one other state, not too many Agunas in North Dakota, as far as I know. So what I had to worry about, or what we worry about, is that we want this Based in America prenuptial agreement to stand scrutiny, even if it's considered a premarital agreement under the law. We did change the name of it, if you see. We call it a binding agreement and not a prenuptial agreement. So one can make a, kind of form over substance or title over substance and say, well, this doesn't say prenuptial agreement, so it's not. But and that made some people happy. But at the end of the day, that is something that we worry about. So my goal, or our goal, is to make sure that even if a court would find that the prenuptial agreement is a premarital agreement, it should still withstand scrutiny. And you'll see that we have a magic trick at the end. So as a matter of contract law, we all know that a contract must be entered into voluntarily and cannot be the product of duress or undue influence. And under the law, that could mean physical compulsion, a gun to the person's head, or it could mean explicit or implicit threat that the person had no reasonable choice other than to sign the document. Okay, so we all know that. Now, as mentioned, in many jurisdictions, courts on premarital agreements, they really search carefully for signs of duress. And why is that? It kind of makes sense because of the close relationship between a husband and wife. And it's often the case that in the context of prenuptial agreements, what I mean, the real prenuptial agreements in secular society, I mean, you generally have one of the spouses or spouses-to-be has more power, more sophistication, more knowledge than the other one. I mean, the typical rock star and groupie. So, the rock star has all the, that was a joke? Okay. So anyway, so generally they, in prenuptial agreements, they, they look for, was there real arm's length negotiation, or was this just plopped in front of the spouse to be and say, you sign it or not? In fact, so you'll see that although in general commercial cases, it's extraordinarily difficult to invalidate a contract based on duress, courts very rarely find duress as a basis to invalidate a commercial contract. If you just take any look, through Westlaw, you'll find lots and lots of cases where courts refuse to enforce premarital agreements due to duress or undue influence. In fact, some states, like Maryland, actually reverse the burden of proof. In a commercial case, a general contract case, the burden is on the person or the party who says that I was under duress to prove duress. Maryland switches the burden of proof that in a premarital agreement, you have to prove the lack of duress in order to enforce it. In fact, in California has a 7-day waiting period. So this is the thing, and I want everyone to listen carefully now. If you're spaced out, that's fine. You're here for CLE credits, that's fine too. But if there's one thing you take away from this, this is what I worry about. The prenuptial agreement is a real contract. The BDA-PNA is a real contract. And I think it's wonderful that the vast majority, the overwhelming majority now of like RCA, OU, Yeshiva University rabbis require the signing of the prenuptial agreement before they'll agree to be Mesad or Kedushin. I think that's great. However, what I've seen happen, and hopefully it's not happening as much because we've started educating people, is that it's become like part of the wedding ceremony. Like at the chassan's tish, people rip it out and say, and now we're going to sign the prenuptial agreement, and it's all a great thing to do, and I love it, and it's good. But the problem is, is that really is not the way to do it. This is a serious contract, and if you look at some of the cases invalidating premarital agreements, it's things like presenting it the day of the wedding, presenting it in an atmosphere where the person doesn't really have a choice whether to sign it or not, because it'll cause extreme embarrassment if the person doesn't sign it. Forcing someone to sign it, not giving someone an opportunity to read it, not giving someone an opportunity to consult an attorney. Those type of things are all indicia of duress under the cases looking at premarital agreements. So what we've been advising rabbis to do is to cut it out and to start presenting the prenuptial agreements, you know, when they meet with the chassan and kala for the first time, give them time to read it, explain what it does, give it time to them if they want to show it to a lawyer, if they want to show it to their parents. We really want to try to change the dynamics. And again, I'm not complaining. I think it's wonderful that folks, kind of try to make a show of doing the prenuptial agreement. As I said, the difference between a situation, and I've been involved with the Beis Din now for a number of years. The difference, and Rabbi Weissman could confirm this, the difference between a potential aguna situation with and or without the prenuptial agreement is like night and day. If there is a prenuptial agreement, all that Rabbi Weissman does, if there's a potential aguna situation, he says, by the way, did you sign a prenup? And the husband says, yes. Rabbi Weissman says, well, why? Maybe show it to your lawyer. And the next day, the guy's there to give a get. I mean, literally. So, or next couple of days. So it really works. So it's a great thing, but it has to be done right. So what we are encouraging is for people to kind of treat it not like, we signed the Ksuba, no offense, we signed the Tanam, we do this, we do that, and then you sign this, but because it really does open up the document to duress challenges. The good news is that New York, New York, when it says New York non-rule, New York doesn't give any special scrutiny to premarital agreements. In fact, even very recently, you see the case in New York, which to me looked like extreme duress, but New York courts are very unsympathetic to claims of duress. So we think that's helpful. The next issue that we talk about or we think about is this is also an issue that we've given a lot of thought to, and that's financial disclosure. Under a number of state statutes or by rule, you need financial disclosure in advance of signing a premarital agreement. And again, this is another one of these round peg square holes. The reason why you need financial disclosure in a quote-unquote real premarital agreement is because people are giving up rights, when they drive up the property, and you have a right to know what you're giving up before you sign a document. Again, this has really nothing to do with the Beis Din of America prenuptial agreement. It's not about, or need not be about, dividing the estate. This is about, solving the aguna issue by the $150 support obligation. And again, what we're solving for, though, is should a court take a very mechanical or approach to the prenuptial agreement and say, hey, it fits into the technical definition of a premarital agreement. So you'll see up on the screen now a number of state statutes. New York, thank God, doesn't have a financial disclosure obligation. In New York, there's no issue. We played with it, to be honest. We considered adding a financial disclosure component to the Beis Din of America prenuptial agreement, and we concluded that that would be a bad idea. Why would it be a bad idea? Because our goal is to get as many couples to sign this as possible, and we worried that if you attach to it, five pages of financial disclosure, people just say, forget about it. So at the end, we decided that that would be a bad idea. So we added waiver language to the prenuptial agreement. We also were very much relying on the fact that in the real world, or this has nothing to do with dividing, or need not have anything to do with dividing the assets of the estate. A judge will understand that. New York doesn't have a financial disclosure requirement. The cases say that if you have independent knowledge of the financial the situation of your spouse to be, that's good enough. And you know, so for all the cases with kids getting married, neither of them have anything, so that's fine. And the bottom line is, if you see, it has to be fair and reasonable. The language used in the financial disclosure requirements, it says fair and reasonable to the challenging party. And again, thinking about what this is, we think a court would take the very pragmatic view that because this isn't about splitting up the assets of the marital assets, instead it was about, you know, solving an issue about the get, that a court would not take a formalistic view of the financial disclosure obligation. Are we doing for time? Okay. Similarly, a number of states have a counsel requirement. New Jersey and California has it by statute that in order to be enforceable, both sides have to have had independent counsel. The good news is these states also allow for waiver. So if you look at the language of our prenuptial agreement, it explicitly waives the right to independent counsel and also explicitly waives the right to any financial disclosure. So based on that, we think that the financial disclosure obligation and the independent counsel obligation should not stand in the way of enforceability of the prenuptial agreement, the Base of America prenuptial agreement. Another issue that we came across, which to me was a bit of a curveball, is that prenuptial agreements or premarital agreements are about what? They're about splitting up property in the event that there's a divorce, right? Number of courts have found that it's against public policy for a premarital agreement to agree to modify the support obligation during a marriage. That, in other words, what prenuptial marital agreements can do is say, okay, you're no longer married, how are we going to divide the property? What it can't do is saying, while you're married, how you're going to divide the property. And that's a matter of public policy because you want spouses to support each other. Good news, again, is that this is not an issue in New York. But why is this an issue for us? Because if you go back to the language of the prenuptial agreement, and this goes back to what Rabbi Reese talked about earlier, the Beis Din wants to be able to order a get before a civil divorce. We're always worried that a husband, that as a civil divorce proceedings go on, things will become much more acrimonious and people will dig in. Also, we're always worried about a husband just taking off and not being able to find. So what triggers the Beis Din to order a get, or for the husband to face the $150 support agreement, is that they determine that they're no longer married, that they're basically not married anymore, that the marriage is over. But technically, they're still married. So one can make the argument as follows. Suppose this is a situation where the wife makes more money than the husband, okay? The husband's a stay-at-home dad. The wife is the bread earner, right? So this support obligation could be read to change a during-marriage support obligation. Why? Because under regular law, if the wife is the bread earner, she has a obligation to support the husband during the marriage. What the prenuptial agreement says, if the Beis Din determines that the marriage is over, even before civil divorce, the husband has to pay her this $150 a day. That's why we added the language you'll see on the bottom, making clear that although we're using the word support, which we have to avoid the word fine, which would put us into get me'usa problems, we're talking about support with a little s and not support with a capital S. What I mean is that this has nothing to do with the support obligation of that spouses owe each other during the marriage. This is separate and apart. So you'll see the language says the support obligation under Jewish law is independent of any civil or state law obligation for spousal support or any civil or state law imposed order for spousal support. So what we've made clear is that although it says the word support, this does not affect the real capital support obligation of a spouse's during a marriage. So those were the issues that we grappled with, among many others, in terms of the enforceability of the prenuptial agreement. I should tell you that the Based in America prenuptial agreement is a living, breathing document. What I mean by that is we're constantly tweaking it and making changes and making it better. People give suggestions and we implement the suggestions. If you blackline where we started from where we are now, you'll see while the, you know, kind of the theory behind it, the idea of, you know, a support obligation, little s, and when the basin determines that the marriage is over, that was always the key. That was always the meat and potatoes. But in terms of the bells and whistles to make it more enforceable, we're constantly looking at it and we're constantly tweaking it. And, you know, at this point, I'm like, come at me. I think it'll work. The good news is that, you know, just so I don't, you know, we spend hundreds of hours worrying about these things. The bottom line is it really, it rarely, if ever, gets challenged, because people just see it and they do the right thing. So this is not something that we have hundreds of cases litigating these issues. This is just what we worry about. A word on, how are we doing? Okay, another bit. A word on postnuptial agreements, nice old couple. Basically the same, there are some states that just refuse to enforce postnuptial agreements, like Ohio, just doesn't work. Some states say it's the same rules as premarital agreements, the heightened scrutiny. That's New York, as opposed to premarital agreements, which is very, you know, kind of liberal. There's a heightened scrutiny in New York for postnuptial agreements. The big issue also with postnuptial agreements is, you know, if for all the lawyers here, there's the issue of consideration. Like for prenuptial agreements, the consideration is getting married. If you're married already, what's the consideration? So people say, well, the consideration could be for continued marriage. Some courts don't like that. It's a bit of a schwer, it doesn't really work so well because you're married anyway. We think that because our postnuptial agreement has you're basically waiving your right to go to court and to submit to the Beis Din, a court would likely find that there is adequate consideration. Let me just add by something that I find absolutely fascinating. This was Professor Helfand, who you're about to hear from's big contribution to the prenuptial agreement, among other things, is that there's something called, this is what I mean, we have a magic trick at the end. What do I mean by the magic trick at the end? There's something that you're going to say, I don't believe you. And then I'm going to say it again, and I'm going to say I don't believe you, because I did this for hours and days with Professor Helfand, who, when I knew him, he was Michael Helfand, and he worked for me down the hall. But it actually works, is that, and I'll do this very quickly, but it's worth thinking about, is that generally, we think whether an arbitration clause is itself enforceable is a matter for a court. In other words, I sign an arbitration agreement with Rabbi Ries. He says it's unenforceable for whatever reason. We would fight that out in court, because that's like a initial, well, do we even get to arbitration? It's actually not the case. Based on a number of, starting with the Prima Payne case in 1967, and this has been affirmed many times and adopted by a majority of states, is that if the arbitration agreement makes clear that enforceability issues are also decided by the arbitrators, i.e. the Beis Din, then it's the arbitrators, not a court, that decides whether or not the arbitration agreement is enforceable. What? How could that make sense? That's circular. The answer is, that's the law. So let me say that again. If you say explicitly in the arbitration agreement that issues of enforceability of the agreement itself should be decided by the arbitrators, not by a court, that in fact is decided by the arbitrators. So all the issues we talked about today, is this a premarital agreement? Is it duress? Do you need was financial disclosure adequate? All of that stuff, based on the language that we added, I don't know why this didn't come elsewhere, they added to the prenuptial agreement, it says, Beit Din America shall have exclusive jurisdiction to decide any disputes relating to the enforceability formation, conscionability, and validity of this agreement, including whether it's void and arbitrability of any disputes arising hereunder, a court will enforce that. So I try to enforce, I say, Rabbi Reese, we signed this arbitration agreement. He says it's void because you had a gun to my head. I did it under duress, and he tries to go to court. I would take this out and say, sorry, Rabbi Reese, or Your Honor, this should be decided by the arbitrators, the issue of duress, not by the court. Under the law, federal law, and under most state law, that would be given to the arbitrator. So even if, you know, so some of these close calls, which I don't think are so close because I think we've dealt with it, but this is our kind of like fail-safe safety mechanism in the built-in, cooked into the prenuptial agreement, that issues of enforceability will be decided by the base bid. So just to conclude, I hope you agree with me now that the Base of America prenuptial agreement, due to the work of the Beis Din and the Rabbanim and a whole group of lawyers that take this stuff very seriously, remains the key and the most effective way to, or the most effective tool to combat the Aguna problem in the United States. I urge you all as communal leaders, as lawyers, or whoever you are, to urge every, not force, but urge all young couples to sign it, or all old couples to sign it in advance of or during their marriage. Thank you.